In a tiny town in upstate New York sits the fortress of Attica. It was built in the Depression era. By 1971, it was 50% over capacity and housed 2,400 prisoners, overwhelmingly black and brown men from the cities. They were fed on 63 cents a day, locked up for most of the day in a cell of only 6 by 9 feet, where a person could barely take 2 steps and had to shit where he sleeps. Prisoners were allowed 1 shower and 1 pair of socks a week, 1 bar of soap and 1 roll of toilet paper a month. They were referred to by number rather than name. In the preceding decades, the civil rights movement against segregation in the southern states of America had changed society. It had trained activists, both black and white, who built a radical student movement. These protests politicized people who had never encountered radical ideas before. The anti-Vietnam War movement grew from the mid-60s to involve hundreds of thousands. There were city riots in Watts and Detroit and many other places, which exposed discrimination that existed outside of the Jim Crow South. And there were anti-colonial rebellions around the world. That militancy and political consciousness didn't stop at the prison gates. It actually gave rise to a national prisoner rights movement. There was a revolutionary spirit in the prison. Jazz Hayden, who was an inmate at Attica, described the prison as a university of radical ideas. People were reading Che and Marx and Lenin, and they were holding political discussions in the prison yard. The horrible conditions, along with the political consciousness, created a tinderbox. Organising was occurring in jails all over the country, and in Attica, there was an increasing unity and coordination between all of the political organisations within the jail. George Jackson, who was arrested as a teenager for petty theft and became a Black Panther and author in jail, was one of the most well-known faces of the prisoner rights movement. And in August 1971, he was murdered at San Quentin Prison, shot in the back by prison guards who claimed he was trying to escape. Outrage swept through prisons and beyond, with writer James Baldwin declaring, "No black person will ever believe that George Jackson died the way they tell us he did." The day after George Jackson's murder, prisoners in Attica Mess Hall wore black armbands and sat in complete silence, displaying impressive coordination and discipline. Prison officials were worried. But instead of granting reforms, which prisoners had been seeking, management tightened discipline. The spark for the Attica Rebellion was very ordinary. Capricious disciplinary practices and the use of solitary confinement as punishment raised tensions. And when prisoners verbally protested, instead of defusing, management locked the prisoners in a hallway, creating chaos. Guards and prisoners were beaten, an old poorly maintained gate came open, and prisoners flooded into the main yard. 1,300 men, over half the prison population, took the open air D yard under their collective control. In the following 4 days, their struggle revealed the conditions of prisoners to the world. It showed the humanity and the agency of prisoners resisting the barbaric prison system and put a spotlight on the brutality of the state. 40 guards were taken hostage in the melee and were placed under organised protection. The prisoners knew that that is what stood between them and an invasion. Prisoners understood their own lives were not considered important, but they had faith that the state cared enough about its employees that their safety would matter. The prisoners organised protection for the hostages. They got mattresses and food. These same guards who had used gratuitous violence against prisoners, who had denied them basic human rights for years, received better conditions and rations than the prisoners did in D Yard. In the yard, those 1,300 men set up a democracy. Each cell block elected representatives to speak for them, speeches were translated into Spanish so that all prisoners were able to follow the proceedings and the debates. Everybody was involved in the organising, decision-making and the work, as Frank Big Black Smith describes in this quote. Communications, security, waste, food, medical treatment, all of it was collectively organised with extremely meagre resources. Tom Wicker, who was a New York Times journalist called on to attend as an observer, was impressed that these alienated, angry men, many of them unschooled, who had been under constant surveillance and control, quickly created a rough social and political order. How could this happen so quickly? Well, I think anyone who has read of revolutions or rebellions like Occupy Wall Street will be familiar with the organisation that can spring up when a group of people have a collective purpose and they need to organise outside of the existing structures. Prisoners showed their humanity and their capacity through this collective struggle. When we are told that those who are in jails are irredeemable, it is a lie. And in struggle, people shed backwards ideas and behaviours that they have learned. This process was also sped up by the years of work already done. Those who had been organising and educating others in the yard had some stature. Political organisations had already been formed and were recruiting within the prisons. It wasn't the case that every prisoner was immediately far-thinking and cool-headed, but those with a more politically developed worldview quickly won arguments to organise collectively and to protect the hostages, even though many others understandably wanted revenge. The prisoners saw an opportunity to show the suffering inside Attica to the world and to win support. They distrusted the state and immediately called on the media to come into the prison, and they demanded that observers assist in the negotiations with prison authorities. The observers were a mixed group. People like Tom Wicker from the New York Times, William Kunstler, a left-wing attorney who defended the Chicago Seven, two Republican senators, a congressman, journalists from Harlem newspapers, and so on. The prisoners' demands were numerous and predominantly practical. They wanted to be treated as human beings, not as beasts. They wanted minimum wage, political and religious freedoms, decent food, medical care, and sanitation. They also wanted an amnesty for punishment for the riot. A few days into the rebellion, a guard who had been crushed in the original chaos died of his injuries. Amnesty from physical and legal reprisals became a significant focus of the negotiations. And there were other more political demands, such as calling to be transported to a non-imperialist country. You get a real sense of the politicisation from this clip of L.D. Barclay, who made clear that the riot was a product of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist prison administration.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such. The entire prison populace has set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We are...
Inside the yard, there was mass decision-making and participation, hunger and cold, anxiety, debates, tension, stoicism and joy. Multiracial organising and solidarity characterised the event, breaking with the historical racial tensions which had been actively stoked by prison management and guards. Speech after speech was made to the assembled crowd of prisoners and observers. These imprisoned men finally had an opportunity to be heard. Brother Flip spoke to the crowd. "If we cannot live as people, then we will at least try to die like men." The crowd erupted in a roar. I love the photographs from inside D Yard. Determination and dignity can be read on the faces of the imprisoned men. but for all the creativity and organisation and resolve of the uprising. On the opposite side of the equation were the forces of the state. The bureaucracy were people like the state governor, Nelson Rockefeller, a liberal Republican from a very powerful capitalist family, and Russell G. Oswald, who was the state corrections commissioner, who oversaw how prisons were run in New York State. And there was also the armed state. While the prisoners were running things inside the yard and the negotiations were in train, every state trooper battalion in the state of New York, every off-duty prison guard and the National Guard were all descending on Attica. Weapons were being passed out indiscriminately. The FBI was on the scene actively spreading rumours that the prisoners were committing atrocities inside the prison. They were consciously and actively fermenting fury in these armed men. There was actually substantial progress with negotiations, getting the state's agreement to many of the prisoners' demands. But Commissioner Oswald and Governor Rockefeller refused to consider the demand for amnesty. Before a settlement could be reached, Rockefeller made the decision to take the prison by force. The prisoners were never offered an ultimatum. They were never warned that this was their final chance to cut a deal. Instead, the state ensured that they thought negotiations were still going on. And so when the prisoners heard a helicopter revving up, they thought that Rockefeller was coming to negotiate as they had requested, and a cheer went up inside the yard. Then it dawned on them that instead repression was coming. They assumed that it would be by guards with nightsticks, as had occurred in previous prison rebellions. They protected themselves with handmade weapons like baseball bats, pipes, or shivs. None of them had access to guns. Prisoners and hostages alike inside were sick with fear at the coming attack. But it was much worse than they could have imagined. A helicopter dumped tear gas over the yard. Canisters exploded. All of the prisoners dropped, blinded, vomiting. At that moment, 300 state troopers entered armed with rifles, personal weapons, deer hunting rifles, and they shot indiscriminately for 15 minutes. On video footage, you can hear from the loud hailer, "Surrender with your hands up and you won't be harmed," while gunfire rang out in the background. 39 people were killed, 128 were injured. Many had 6, 7, and 8 bullet wounds. 10 of the dead were those state employees taken hostage in the hope of protection. It turned out their lives didn't matter either. I'm going to show a video now. I'm sorry it's not the best quality, but you'll see hundreds of the Attica rioters rounded up with their hands on heads, and you'll also see the attitude of some of the state forces.
I smell gas. This some sort of tear gas. And I heard the sounds of shooting. And I knew that people were being murdered inside there. And I began to cry.
Good evening. The four-day insurrection at New York's Attica State Prison came to a tragic end this morning. Negotiations gave way to force, making this the bloodiest prison incident the country has seen in 4 decades.
White power! White power! White power!
The retaking of the prison was just the beginning. For weeks, horrific torture followed. There were beatings, people pushing injured victims off stretchers, urinating in open wounds. The National Guard were the very unlikely good guys in this scenario. They were trying to enter as medics and were being prevented from rendering medical care. This description of torture by Frank Big Black Smith, who was a prisoner and organiser, was not unique. Leaders of the rebellion were specifically targeted for punishment, And in the case of 21-year-old L.D. Barkley, who gave the speech that I showed earlier, he was denied medical care, leading to his death. On the day of the massacre, state officials stood in front of the prison and told the world that the prisoners killed the hostages. They slit their throats and castrated one of the guards. Headlines across the country read, "Barbaric prisoners slaughter guards." It was a complete fabrication. All had been killed by the state, by gunfire. The fabrication was cover for the utter barbarity of the state repression. But most importantly, it was intended to squash mass sentiment for prisoner rights and prison reform. If the public were to see the humanity of the Attica prisoners, it could bring into question the entirety of the prison system and law and order in general. Seeing the most dehumanised and atomised people join in solidarity across racial lines in a fight against the state might just inspire others to fight back too. And so for the state, nothing could be too brutal to stamp out these potential lessons. Leaked tapes of a conversation between President Richard Nixon and Governor Rockefeller exposed that Rockefeller thought up to 200 or 300 inmates might be killed, and he thought the price was worth it. Nixon congratulated him on retaking the prison. I think this whole question, it's something that liberal commentators on the Attica Rebellion get really confused about. Why did the state do this when it wasn't necessary? Of course, the state did not need to send in a mass of armed troops shooting openly to end this rebellion. It was September and getting colder quickly. There was no running water, no toilets, no additional supplies. The rebellion could not continue indefinitely. The decision to take the prison by force and the level of brutality employed was a very conscious choice. Some comment on Governor Rockefeller's plan to run against Nixon for president, they kind of see the importance of him personally appearing tough on law and order. But I think there's a more important reason that the FBI and the state apparatus at all levels were on board with that. The severity of violence in repressing the Attica uprising was a message to anyone who considered rebellion. This is the price. There is no compromise from the state. Sorry, I've gone out of order. The savagery of the repression reflected the extent to which the authorities were driven by fear of the revolt spreading. As Commissioner Oswald put it later, we were dealing with a very sophisticated and determined coalition of revolutionaries who were trying to exploit public sympathy to achieve their political objectives, to trigger a chain reaction, undermining authority everywhere. There's a lot in this quote. It's really notable that this quite spontaneous rebellion could shake the power of the state so much. I think that's very inspiring. And the prisoners definitely did see the potential for workers and the poor to show solidarity and empathy with their plight. And they called for public support to improve conditions inside the prisons. They wanted people to see that prisoners were just like everyone else, screwed over by the system. And quite a few of them were revolutionaries, and their organising was much stronger for it. They had read of and learned from other fights against injustice. But that authority that the commissioner was so eager to uphold, the capitalist state, is a linchpin for capitalist society. It's a society so fundamentally unequal and unfair that it cannot be maintained without a violent, repressive apparatus. Much of the time, they rule by coercion and consent. But police and prisons serve as the threat to the working class and the poor. If you don't follow the rules, we will make you suffer. There are now over 2 million people imprisoned in the United States, which is an enormous crime in its own right. Human beings were not meant to be caged. That is, like, the fact that it is a normal practice to take away years of somebody's life on the basis of drug charges or crimes of poverty and so on should make anyone question society. The Black Lives Matter movement shone a light on the level of violence meted out by police and prison guards. For young men of colour, police violence is among the leading causes of death in the United States. Here in Australia, Aboriginal men like David Dungay Jr. and children like Dylan Voller are routinely brutalised and even murdered behind bars. The prison population mainly come from a disadvantaged background. In Australia, over one third of prisoners are of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander background, just as people of colour are much overrepresented in Attica. Prisons do not rehabilitate people. They damage prisoners further, and they're hugely costly, but they don't prevent crime. Like the police, prisons exist for the ruling class. They don't exist to protect us. The armed wing of the state is intended to protect the power and the property of the rich. And for that reason, law and order is a really important component of reactionary capitalist ideology. The fear of crime can help justify enormous spending on police and prisons, as well as providing a scapegoat for social problems that are actually created by capitalism itself. And so we see this really intense reporting of instances of interpersonal violence and violent crime, which is actually a product of a deeply alienated and armed society. But on the other side, state violence is normalised and even glamorised. Think about the discussion of nuclear submarines and all their killing capacity. The real criminals are the leaders of this violent society. Those people who waged war on Vietnam caused the deaths of over 3 million Vietnamese civilians and soldiers and over 50,000 American troops, and they will never see the inside of a jail cell. Nelson Rockefeller and Russell Oswald murdered 39 at Attica, and they were never held responsible, nor were the troopers who killed and tortured inmates. As Angela Davis wrote from her own prison cell in October 1971, the violence at Attica wasn't an aberration, but part of standard practice. The American state spread violence wherever it went. In savage repression of Black folks seeking civil rights and an end to racial segregation. In the murder of student protesters in Orangeburg, Jackson State, and Kent State. In the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, in which American soldiers murdered villagers. In the execution of George Jackson in San Quentin Jail. And in locking so many innocent people behind bars, people who are a product of their violent system. Marxist politics tell us that the state is not a neutral body. It cannot be held back by a group of influential observers or swayed by evidence that prisons do not rehabilitate those who are imprisoned. The capitalist state is an instrument of class rule. The repression that was meted out at Attica wasn't merely directed at the prisoners in D Yard, but at the Black Power revolt and the wider social upheaval in the United States. In those rebellions, the oppressed could see the possibility of a different society. Although the following year saw a record number of riots inside US prisons, the prisoner riots and Black liberation movements did begin to decline in the face of intense state violence and repression. But nevertheless, prisoner resistance did win reforms. Some improvements in conditions were achieved. By 1982, college prison educational programs were created across the country. But like every reform that we win through struggle under capitalism, these gains are always partial and they can be retracted. And this has subsequently been wound back. Activists in the United States consider that the conditions in Attica now are worse than they were in 1971. And we can see how many prisoners have died during the COVID pandemic spreading like wildfire through these hellholes. The capitalist system in which mass imprisonment and police brutality is normalised and necessary for the rich to keep control, can never meet humanity's needs or desires. The Attica Rebellion should provide us with inspiration that human beings can and will resist, that we should organise and educate ourselves and fight against injustice. As one of the Attica prisoners put it, after the rebellion, a lot of us died, a lot of us were wounded, but none of us had any regrets because of what we did. As a matter of fact, if we had another opportunity, we would have done it again and again, because it was better than being treated like animals. We should take inspiration from their courage and their vision for a better world, and organise to win a world without prisons.